Three different worldviews tonight. When you think about worldviews, you can break them down into general structures, I suppose you could say. For one, theism, belief in an infinite personal God. The way that I captured this here was you have God is not only creating the world, but also involved in the world. So that arrow goes down all the way in order to show miracles are possible and actual. And then humans are also praying to God. And so the arrow going up is showing that there's a relationship between the world, that is the universe, and God. Then you have deism. And if you notice, there's a short arrow. Deism has been compared to God winding up the universe like a watch and then just letting it go. So the absentee father, he starts the universe and then he leaves and doesn't touch anything. Then we also have agnosticism. This is from humans looking up at God, not really knowing if he's there, not knowing if he's real. It isn't the outright denial that God exists. That would be atheism. This is looking up at God and saying there is no God, for sure. Agnosticism is basically saying that we have a lack of knowledge and we just don't know. So maybe he is there, maybe he's not. Deism is saying there is a God and yet he's not involved. And theism is, there is a God, and he is involved. If we were to break this down even further, we could get into polytheism, that is poly meaning many, as well as pantheism, where God is pan, everything. God is in everything, God is everything. Or panentheism, and all these other different forms, finite godism, and so forth. But if you could just get these down here, theism, deism, agnosticism, and atheism, polytheism, pantheism, that would get you pretty far in understanding different worldviews. Let's start with deism. Deism. Just picture that you have some kind of a toy, like a monkey with the symbols, and you wind it up, and you import energy into the toy, and that kinetic energy ends up resulting in the monkey hitting the symbols together. And this is kind of an illustration, illustrative of what God is like under deism, where he winds up the universe, fine-tunes it, creates it from nothing, and yet just lets it go. Doesn't answer prayer, doesn't intervene. So under this view, we would believe that an infinite personal God does exist, and yet he just never intervenes into his universe. There's no reason for him to intervene because he's a deistic type of God. So for this reason, miracles are rejected. A deist wouldn't believe in miracles any more than an atheist would. Under this view, they believe in what Francis Schaeffer referred to as the uniformity of cause and effect in a closed system. So if you're looking at a system, the universe, it's uniform. There's the uniformity, meaning it's always the same. It's uniform. And what's it uniformly going to do? The uniformity of cause and effect. Natural law, physics, chemistry, and that's it. In a closed system. So if the universe could be represented as a bathtub, everything happening in the bathtub is a closed system. But in the theistic universe, it is the uniformity of cause and effect, yes. There is natural law, yes. There is physics and chemistry, yes. But it isn't a closed system. If you were to look at the universe as a bathtub, it's admitting that there's a plumber on the outside that can come in and actually operate on what's happening. Not my best illustration, but I hope you guys get the idea. It isn't a closed system, but an open system. Well, deism, they believe that God exists, but that he just won't or decides not to intervene into the world, thus making it a closed system. Here's a really complicated term. This is methodological naturalism. Now, ontological naturalism, ontos, means being, what exists, like what's at the core of things. And so ontological naturalism would say, or metaphysical naturalism would say, that at the core of things, there's only nature and nothing beyond it. So just physics, chemistry, matter, energy, motion, time, chance. That's it. In its essence, that's all reality is metaphysical naturalism. Nothing beyond the natural. See, a deist doesn't believe that. A deist believes that there is naturalism, but there is a God above nature. But for all intents and purposes, they act like metaphysical naturalists. So they say, no, 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 we believe in God. We're not metaphysical naturalists, because that would mean we only believe in nature. So we're not metaphysical naturalists, we're methodological naturalists. We basically, our methodology is to act as though there were no God. So when you think of things like miracles, a deist would be just as fervent, just as adamant that a miracle doesn't exist as an atheist. Because through their methodology, whether that's history, science, anything, they're going to say, no, there's nothing beyond nature that would impact the world. Just to capture this, one of the most famous deists, not the most influential, but one of the most famous deists would be Thomas Jefferson from the 19th century, where he published his Jeffersonian Bible called The Life and Morals of Jesus. I wonder why it wasn't called The Life and Miracles of Jesus. Well, because Jefferson went through the New Testament and, I mean, not exaggerating too much, with a Sharpie, went through and marked out all of the miracles. Or with an X-Acto knife, went through and cut out all the miraculous times that Jesus performed a miracle. And all that was left in the Jeffersonian Bible were the morals and teachings of Jesus. So this would be a really strident example of the extent to which you need to go in order to get rid of miracles from the Bible, is literally to cut them out. That's how he did it. Because he didn't believe in the supernatural interfering. So he believed there was a God, but not that God would intervene in a miraculous way. You might say, well, I don't know if I've really talked to too many deists before. When's the last time you said, you know, do you have any spiritual beliefs? And someone said, yes, I'm a deist. Doesn't happen that frequently. And yet, according to authorities like Christian Smith from the National Study of Youth and Religion, this organization coined an expression to describe Generation Z and also millennials, which is this: they believe in moralistic therapeutic deism. Moralistic therapeutic deism. So they believe in God. Most people you're going to talk to, they're going to believe in God. Is he the kind of God that would part the Red Sea, though? Is he the kind of God that would create humans de novo, out of nothing? No. Is he the kind of God that would, you know, feed 5,000 men with just a few fishes and loaves? Not that kind of a God. He's a deistic kind of God. Like, he's up there, he's out there. And maybe you pray to him, or maybe you're praying to the universe. We're not really sure. But there's some kind of, like, I don't know, what would you call it? A higher power. It's like something above us. And it's kind of therapeutic for me to believe that. Makes me feel better. So when someone is on the operating table, maybe I wouldn't say that I'm praying for them, but I'm saying, hey, I'm sending good thoughts your way. Sending good, and I've never understood what that means. I'm sending good thoughts your way. And it's also moralistic that if I lead a good life, that's good enough. So there is a God or some kind of a faceless higher power. It's good to believe in he, she, it, or they, or whatever. And if I lead a good life, that's good enough. Well, what's our critique of deism? For one, this is an exhaustive knowledge claim. To be able to claim that there is a God, and I know that he doesn't interfere or intervene into the universe, is an infinite knowledge claim. And that person bears the burden of proof when they say, I know he doesn't intervene. Now, if they come back and say, well, where has he intervened? We could argue, well, predictive prophecy, for one. The resurrection, for two. Different apologetics from natural theology, cosmology, abiogenesis, fine-tuning, and so forth. We could say, well, we have good reason to think that God intervened and is a miracle-working God. Under this view, we could also critique them because they believe in an infinite personal God, and an infinite personal God can do anything possible, but they're saying that they know he doesn't do miracles. Now, does anyone else see a problem with this? Infinite personal God can do anything, and yet they're handcuffing him, saying, no, but he doesn't do miracles. How do you know that? How do you know that an infinite personal God hasn't done a miracle? It seems to me that it's inconsistent to admit the miracle of creation, which they affirm. They say, yes, the universe did burst into existence, that God created the universe. And they would even affirm fine-tuning. Yeah. They would affirm God on the level of physics, but they wouldn't affirm him on any other level beneath it. So biology, history, sometimes you'll meet historians that say, I'm a Christian, but as a historian, I'm a methodological naturalist. And so when I approach the New Testament, yes, I'm a Christian in faith, but I base the miracles of the New Testament on the historical criteria, and historians can't prove that miracles ever happened. And so you're kind of confused. You're like, well, how is that even possible? You can be a Christian and yet not affirm miracles. It's because in one realm, they're affirming some kind of nebulous, vague faith. But in another realm, they're saying, really, I don't believe that God intervenes. I don't think he does miracles. And as a historian, I can't affirm that. Which really, the problem isn't with the history at that point. The problem is with your methodology. Is your methodology of naturalism true? Well, that's deism. What about agnosticism? And you might be saying, why is that the picture? A guy scratching his head. Because this could represent agnosticism pretty well. In Greek, the alpha privative refers to the negation. So not. It's a prefix that basically means not. And gnosko means to know. And then an ism is a worldview. So not to know worldview. Basically what agnosticism states is, I don't know. Beats me. Just to give you an idea of agnosticism, I brought a little video that kind of explains this.
And if this food comes as a gift from some divine intelligence, we understand that an intelligent being cannot blame us for questioning its existence. Nobody knows, nobody can know, if any deity is watching over us. Amen.
So this is the one, this is South Park. Probably the best satire on television, because they go after everyone, even agnostic people. The people that, you know, are saying, I don't have a view, I just don't know. And they're like, we're going to make fun of you too. You're part of the club. Here's another clip here.
This is where you'll sleep with your foster brothers. You will be clean, polite, and most importantly, you will follow the agnostic code. We cannot know with certainty if God or Christ exists. They could. Then again, there could be a giant reptilian bird in charge of everything. Can we be certain there isn't? No. So it's pointless to talk about. Now say it with me.
So that's agnosticism. Now, of course, that's satirical. But the point is to drive home that they're basically saying, I don't know. You say, do you believe in God? Beats me. Well, do you think God exists? Not sure. Are you open to it? Well, some would say yes. I am open to it. Others would say no. Norman Geisler, the philosopher, said that there were two types of agnostics, the strong and the weak. In the strong form of agnostics, he called ornery agnostics. And the second type he called ordinary agnostics. Now you know what the word ornery means, right? It means kind of mean, aggressive, ornery. And then ordinary just means like you're run-of-the-mill agnostic. Well, a strong agnostic, or what he called an ornery agnostic, this is all tongue-in-cheek, by the way, not that you'd ever want to call somebody an ornery agnostic. Under this view of strong agnosticism, basically, we're asking the question, are you saying that you don't know if there's a God? Or are you saying nobody can know? That would differentiate between an ornery and an ordinary agnostic. If they say, I don't know, beats me. There might be, there might not be. That's an ordinary, a soft agnostic. If they're saying, no, I'm saying nobody can know. Which is the position of Bart Ehrman currently. I mean, currently as in the last couple months, where he switched over and realized, I'm no longer an atheist. I'm actually agnostic. I really don't know. I'm not sure. But he's saying, nobody can know. It's not just that I don't know, nobody can know. So he went from kind of a weak atheism to a strong agnosticism. Well, to this, we would just have to come back and ask the question, how do you know that? If you're saying that you don't know, I guess, well, that's, maybe you just have never seen evidence, and are you open to evidence? But for somebody to say nobody can know, you're saying there have been 100 billion people on Earth who have ever lived. There's people with degrees, you know, longer than their name, the letters attached to their names. And you're saying that not one of them could know if God exists? Are you saying you know that God has never revealed himself to anybody ever before? How could you possibly know that? How could you possibly know that nobody can know? Again, this claim that God is completely unknowable is an omniscient knowledge claim. Omni meaning all, science meaning knowledge. All-knowing claim. So this is actually a self-defeating statement. To say, I know that nobody knows. Well, I'm part of nobody, or part of everybody, and so therefore I don't know. Well, if I don't know, then maybe it's possible that people do know. So instead of being a very modest claim, this is an extraordinary claim to say that nobody on planet Earth knows this. Of course, we would find common ground with agnostics in the sense that we would admit that God is only partially knowable. We're not making the statement, a foolish statement, that we know God completely or fully. We're making the claim that we can know God truly. So, Deuteronomy 29:29, the secret things belong to the Lord, but the things he's revealed belong to you and your children forever and ever. Or 1 Corinthians 13:12, now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know fully, just as I have been fully known. So this isn't the claim that we know God exhaustively or fully, but we do know him truly. We might compare this to your iPhone, if you have one. You look at your iPhone, I look at this piece of equipment here, and I'm like, you know, I know that it can communicate with other people. I know if I punch in certain numbers, I can call my friends and family. I even know that it has something to do with satellites and towers and stuff. But beyond that, I gotta be honest, I really don't know too much more. Like, how does the battery turn on the circuits to get the thing booted up? What's the relationship between the hardware and the software? When you get apps, how are those coded? And what kind of code and what format? Honestly, there's a lot more about this phone that I don't know than I do know. But would I go so far as to say that I don't know that I have a phone? No, I know it truly, even if I don't know it fully. What about any person you've ever met? Even the closest relationship in your life, whether that's a spouse or a close friend or a family member, you would say that you know them truly. I know them, but I don't know them fully. For example, I don't know how many cells are in their body. I don't know every secret that they have. I don't know every thought that they've ever thought about. But it would be false to say, that's a false dichotomy, I guess is what I'm saying, is that I need to know them fully in order to know them truly. What about the ordinary or soft agnostic? The importance here is that many people are in this camp, that they're just saying, I don't know. That could be the case. That could be true. I'm just not sure. It's important to try and help people in this position to get them to see the import of what we're discussing. We're talking about things like the meaning of life, transcendence, eternal life, God, if he's there, if you could know him, do you have a soul? Will it transcend death? I mean, whether or not we could know these things, let's shelve that for a second. But will you at least admit that it's important? For example, imagine if you had a little kid and that little child was dying of some kind of a strange disease. And just as you're kind of coming to terms with the fact that that child is going to die, a doctor busts in through the door shaking a handful of pills. And he says, you know, I just got back and we got these pills tested and they're going to cure your little girl. So instead of only living to age 5, she's going to live to age 80. Whoa. Wow. That's going to increase her lifespan, 16-fold? And yet, at the same time, I don't know if you're in my shoes, you might be thinking, wait a minute, he's just shaking these pills. So how much are the pills worth? And he's like, $20. And it's going to cure her. Yeah. See, I don't know if I'd be thinking he's a quack, like this is some kind of a snake oil he's trying to sell. He sees we're all crying, we're weak, and he's trying to take advantage of us. I don't know, I'd be kind of suspicious. I'd want to see some ID. You know, are you a real medical doctor? How do we know he's not some kind of a con man? At the same time, all those things could be true. At the same time, at the very least, we'd have to admit that what he's claiming is incredibly important. That I could extend my daughter's life to 80 instead of just to, you know, 80 minutes into the future. Well, what if there was a chance that you could extend your life, you know, from 80 years to 100, or 100 to 200, 200 to 500? See, honestly, in a fallen world, I don't know if I'd even want that. You know, to keep on living here with all this death and decay and destruction, distrust. But what if we could extend our lives in a perfect world? You know, that may be true, it may be false, but at least we have to admit it's worth exploring, it's worth looking into. And with an ordinary agnostic trying to urge them, trying to give some simple illustrations to show, wouldn't it be worth your time to look into this? So try and encourage interest. You're trying to argue against apathy, I guess is what I'm saying. And trying to ask the person, are they open-minded? If you're dealing with a person and they're saying, I'm open-minded, then say, why not look into this with me? Why not pray that? Well, I don't know. If I pray, you know, I'm not really the praying type. Yes, but if there is an infinite personal God who loves you and did everything he could to reach you, it seems to me that if you prayed to him, he would respond on such a crucial issue regarding eternal life, that he would speak to you in some way. Yeah, he would communicate with you. I don't know how that's going to look. I know for me it was way different than for other people. At the same time, why not do that? Why not pray what they call a doubter's prayer? Why not look into some evidence? Well, that would be agnosticism.